And now, a man who campaigned against Barack Obama in all 57 states, Mark Gillar.
Welcome to the Tea Party Power Hour. I am Mark Gillar. Our special guest today is Mr. Jack Cashel. He is the author of many very successful books, including Ron Brown's Body, Hoodwinked, and one that I'm sure is going to stay on the New York Times bestseller list for a long time, Deconstructing Obama. Jack, welcome to the show.
Hey, thanks for having me on, Mark. It's an honor, and hello to all my Tea Party friends.
Well, we've got a lot of them out there, you know, when they're not busy being racist or violent.
Yeah, right,
or,
exactly.
You know.
And they're violent, they're so unlike the union people in Wisconsin and elsewhere, you know, who always protest peacefully and in civilly, you know.
Absolutely. In fact, they're great role models for the rest of us. And for if there are any Tea Partiers out there that just want to, you know, walk away right now and turn on the television and watch those union people in Wisconsin or Ohio or anywhere else, you know, because they are such good role models, will understand. I got to tell you, I remember when you first came out with the possibility that Barack Obama's book, Dreams from My Father, may have actually been ghostwritten by Bill Ayers. The first thought that went through my head was, this is almost too good to be true. I can't believe it after watching
too.
Barack Obama say that Bill Ayers is a guy who lives in my neighborhood.
Yeah.
So tell us, what was that eureka moment? When did you first think that this might be a possibility?
Well, you know, and it's odd because my reaction was like yours. I almost laughed. I said, oh, no, this can't be. This is too good. You know, I had stumbled on Dreams in the summer of 2008, around July. Someone sent me a list of excerpts, and they said, hey, you know, I had not read Dreams from My Father. And this is Obama's acclaimed 1995 memoir. And why it's important is because the whole myth of the Obama genius is based on this one book. And he wrote it presumably as a 33-year-old, and it published in 1995. And I hadn't read it. Someone sent me a bunch of excerpts and said, are these as radical as they sound? And so what I did is I was in the Detroit airport, got stuck, and so I bought the book and highlighted, went through looking for the passages and found them. And what I discovered was that the excerpts were all taken out of context. They weren't as radical as they sounded. Usually they were quotes by someone else. But what I discovered was something else, is that very quickly, just looking at it, I said, no, this is simply too good. It's too well written. And I say this because in my 25-year career in publishing and advertising, I've had to review the portfolios of at least 1,000 professional writers, you know, to hire them. And I only saw a half dozen that could write as well as the best passages were written in Dreams. So I immediately knew that there was something up, and I presumed that everyone knew. I just hadn't been paying much attention to the book or Obama campaign. And so I went online and I Googled Obama ghostwriter, Obama ghostwritten, you know, that sort of those kind of combinations. And what I got was this: unlike John McCain, Barack Obama does not need a ghostwriter. His unique genius, blah, blah, blah. Not a single person out there, including the people on the right, the literary people on the right, had spotted, which to me was just painfully obvious. You know, I had written a book earlier, Mark, on a literary fraud called Hoodwinked, and so I was, you know, aware of how it works, and especially on the left, because they control all the gates in the literary establishment, and they can choose to let things in or let them out or approve them or not approve them. And they're very comfortable with fraud. And so that didn't surprise me. What surprised me was that our own people, the people on the right, had let this slide by, and it was transparently not his book. But I had no idea whose it was. At least not then.
Now,
what happened? No, go ahead. Sorry.
I was going to say, Fugitive Days came out after Dreams from My Father. So, being that Barack Obama's so brilliant, maybe he was the ghostwriter for Bill Ayers' book.
Well, that's oddly what the London Times suggested, which was absolutely, utterly, thoroughly mad. But you're right, it did come out afterwards, and in fact it had the most unfortunate publishing history of any book in the last century, and actually just as well. Ayers had a glowing article about him, I mean, at least a 1,000-word article, in the New York Times about his book. And it was exquisitely non-judgmental in the New York Times style. Why hold a grudge against a guy who simply blew up our buildings and tried to kill our soldiers? And it came out on the worst possible morning for an unrepentant terrorist, which was September 11, 2001. So after 2 years of, I mean, after about 2 hours of enjoying the fruits of his success, he was relegated to obscurity and infamy. So you can understand why it must be a little frustrating for him to watch what has since happened to Dreams. But in 1995, how I stumbled on it is because I read, after about 6 weeks after I read Dreams, and just on another tangent altogether, I picked up a copy of Fugitive Days. I just wanted to see at the time whether Ayers, Bill Ayers, the terrorist, and Barack Obama had met before Chicago. I just was tracking their story to see how much truth there was to it. And I had no suspicion at the time that Ayers, I knew nothing about his background as a writer and as editor. I just simply didn't know. So when I'm reading the book, I'm about one-third of the way through, and I had my first eureka moment. But it was actually kind of a stupid eureka moment because I thought, look at this. The styles are very similar. They're both in Chicago. They're both left-wingers. They must have the same ghostwriter. You know, that was my conclusion.
Well, I mean, that's understandable.
Yeah, right. I mean, because I didn't know that Ayers was a writer. But then,
well,
by the time
that a guy had that could was so good at blowing up buildings might also be a good writer. It's understandable.
Right. Well, yeah. What happened? Yeah. Right. Exactly. They're complementary skills. Actually, he's a better writer than he is a blower up or a building because he lost his girlfriend in a bomb blast in Greenwich Village. But by the time I finished Fugitive Days, I realized that Ayers, the book was written by Ayers. I mean, every sentence in Fugitive Days is tight and succinct and comparably styled. In Dreams, that's not true. There are good passages, and then there are stretches that just sort of go on and wander and get tedious, and it's an overly long book. It's not particularly well-structured. It's not a particularly interesting book, actually. I don't know why it's – well, I know why it sold millions of copies. I wonder how many of those people actually read the book. But Fugitive Days is a much more interesting read because, you know, for one thing, say what you will about Bill Ayers. He lived an eventful life at a very eventful time. You know, he had some real adventures. And so, but most of it is about, you know, his life as an underground warrior. And by the time I was finished, I felt that I was onto something. And then I started gathering other evidence. I tried to talk to Obama's agent. She wouldn't talk to me, of course. And,
the one that had been fired.
Yeah, he had dumped her. That's why I thought she might be willing to talk, because after Dreams became a success in 2004, when Obama gave the keynote speech at the convention, he renegotiated his contracts and got a new contract for books, and he cut her out of the deal. She had stuck with him for 15 years, and he cut her right out of the deal, and he hired a by-the-hour attorney. It cost her about $500,000. I mean, just an utterly ungrateful, ruthless bit of business dealing. And so I thought she might want to talk, but she didn't. And I gathered as much evidence as I could to make my case, and I found more and more, and I went public on about September 18, 2008 in the World Net Daily with a speculative article entitled Who Wrote Dreams for, I mean, Did Bill Ayers Write Dreams for My Father? I'd written a Who Wrote about 6 weeks earlier. And this time I started getting really good help from all over the world, actually, from people who had similar suspicions and who were doing, I cite the one guy in the book who deserves attention because he's typical of what makes America great and what makes grassroots America so much smarter and more productive than the people who sit around Washington on our side or theirs. He read the article. His name's Ryan Geiser, and he was sending me these great insights. You know, he was doing comparative, you know, checking. He was ahead of me on some books. And I said, boy, Ryan, I'd like to give you credit. This is into early September, for what you're doing. Yeah, you sent me some really, really good stuff. And he goes, after what happened to Joe DePlummer, I just didn't keep my name out of this. If you recall, Joe DePlummer was summarily eviscerated for daring to confront Barack Obama on the question of his spread the wealth around comment. And so I said, well, let me at least, Brian, let me at least talk about your credentials, because that way, you know, I can, you know, I figured he was some graduate student or professor somewhere. And then he writes back and he says, well, my credentials aren't going to impress anyone, really. He goes, I'm a 39-year-old father of three with a small construction company in Kearney, Nebraska. And after I wrote the – when I was writing the book, Mark, I asked Ryan, and he allowed me finally to use the name. I hadn't used it up to that point publicly. I said, how did you get into this? And then – and his answer really explains the value of the Internet and the failure of our betters to understand the Internet. I mean, Thomas Friedman calls it an open sewer. I mean, things like that. Well, here's what Ryan said. He goes, I read your article in WorldNet Daily, and I said, huh, that's interesting. I wonder if it's true. He didn't say, oh, this must be true. That's what the people in Washington think we think. He said, I wonder if it's true. So he said, I went online. I looked up Ayers' resume, and I ordered all of his books. And I started comparative checking, you know. And then he said, he goes, I can't believe I've never had this much fun doing research. He goes, it's like being the first guy in at Sutter's Creek, you know, just nuggets everywhere. And they weren't even carefully hidden. And that was Ayers's, in a sense, finally, Ayers's, if this ever goes public, Ayers' the undoing is that he, unlike most ghostwriters who simply want to do a job and pass unnoticed, that's why they call them ghosts, you know, in other words, you write in the author's voice and you write his thoughts, Ayers wrote in his own voice and imposed his own thoughts. And it was just too obvious. It should have been obvious to everyone. And then as I started to build my case into October, in fact, on October 9th, American Thinker ran a big article, like 3,700 words. I need a lot of words to make my case. They ran a big article. Limbaugh jumped on it. And then I thought, you know, now we're 4 weeks out before the election. I'm sitting on the October surprise. I could actually turn the election, you know, which you're just some guy in Kansas City with this idea, you know, just it's kind of weird.
I've had other guests on that thought they had the October surprise. Anita Moncrief, a whistleblower at Acorn, who said that the Obama campaign turned over to Acorn a list of donors who were maxed out so that Acorn could swim for more and, of course, funnel that money back to the campaign. But she
right.
had the October surprise. And, of course, the New York Times decided that they couldn't print a game changer that close to the election. So
exactly. And they even admitted it, you know?
Yeah, I don't think any October surprises were going to be allowed by the mainstream media.
No, in fact, that doesn't surprise me. Although, you know, I mean, on the Republican side, they're looking to the last weekend. Look at George Bush's DUI. Had that not come out, he would have won the 2000 election easily. There would not have been that climactic, you know, month in Florida. But
hanging Chaz.
Yeah, right. I mean, words that we didn't even know existed before, you know.
Right.
But
what I recall the embarrassing thing about that was that all the senior citizens in Florida said that the voting process was just so complicated, and they gave the exact same process to a bunch of kindergartners and asked them to pick their favorite Disney character, and then afterwards asked them who their favorite Disney character was, and every single one of them had voted correctly, so...
Which tells us that maybe
I don't know what that says about
Florida shouldn't be allowed to vote, you know.
Exactly.
At least old Democrats in Florida, you know, they're easily befuddled anyhow. I mean, but you know what kind of surprised me, and you probably have seen this, Mark, is that the conservative media were so slow and so reluctant and so scared of this whole issue. I don't understand why. I mean, if I got a guy in Central Nebraska, after a day of framing and drywalling, doing more serious literary research than the literary editors in National Review and Weekly Standard, you got to ask yourself, what's going on here? You know, why aren't they doing what he's doing? And they don't have to go out framing houses all day long. You know, I mean, constructing warehouses. I mean, they don't have anything to do but be literary editors. And what were they concentrating on in the month of October 2008 when it mattered? Certainly not this, you know.
Well, there was that whole Sarah Palin thing going on.
Well, there was that, of course. In fact, and when her book came out, Going Rogue, came out in 2009, and now she's not even a candidate, the Associated Press alone dispatched 11 fact-checkers to go over her account, or over her book, and make sure it was accurate. And they were down to things like, how much she charged for a hotel room in New York. You know, not in Obama's case, as I mentioned in the book, we don't even know where he was born or when he was born. You know, you think those would be a little more relevant issues.
Yeah, when you've got a bunch of fictitious characters, composite characters, and you feel free to change the dates around, that kind of stuff is hard to dig out.
Well, in fact, that's what he and Ayers both do, and they both admit to doing it, you know.
Palin was criticized for not having, for not admitting that she had a ghostwriter. I beg your pardon?
Oh, she admitted she had a ghostwriter.
But she didn't give them credit.
Oh, yes, she did.
Okay.
That was the real difference. They even when they first announced the book deal, her publisher announced who her collaborator would be. And it's a woman, and her name is cited right up in the acknowledgments. In Dreams from My Father, there is no acknowledgement section, which is totally weird. But.
So what was the criticism, that she didn't have the ghostwriter's name on the cover? It wasn't Sarah Palin with?
She didn't have it on the cover. John McCain, for instance, in his book, did have it on the cover. His book, Dreams from My Father, not Dreams from My Father, Faith of My Father. Odd that they would have similar titled books. Yeah, he had his right on the cover. It was John McCain with Mark Salter. But I suspect the reason that Sarah Palin did not have hers is she probably did more of the writing than John McCain did, who probably didn't do any of the writing. He probably just told it as a story, you know?
Well, I can recall duking it out in the blogosphere with a bunch of people when Palin's book came out, and they were all saying, you know, she should put her ghostwriter on the cover. And my response was, I don't recall Bill Ayers being on the cover of Dreams from My Father.
Well, let alone, for instance, Hillary Clinton, It Takes a Village. She didn't even acknowledge her ghostwriter. And her ghostwriter wrote the book. You know, it wasn't like she just sort of, edited it. She wrote it. But she didn't get any credit.
Are you suggesting that there shouldn't be a double standard between the left and the right?
Oh, I'm sorry. I forgot.
Yeah.
We need that standard.
I'm sorry, I couldn't help but throw it. You just never know what's going to tumble. I was going to say, you just never know what's going to tumble out of my mouth. But that's an inside joke. If you don't get it, not you, but if the folks at home don't get it, read the book.
Yeah, you know, you think they'd have the people in the media would tire of the charade of feigning objectivity. You know what I mean? It's got to be wearing on them after a while, because it's so ludicrous, and you know. But they continue.
Some people made that a compliment for Keith Olbermann after he parted ways with MSNBC. Some had said that, say what you want to about Keith Olbermann, but at least, you know, he didn't feign objectivity. He let you know what he was up front, in a way, that's better than, you know, Good Morning America pretending to be objective and then filtering everything through a leftist prism.
Right, and their great screening is the screening factor. I mean, people like me will never be let on those shows. I mean, they shape the news most dramatically.
I can't imagine that you would be, because you don't have to get very far into the book before you start looking at these comparisons. And I know at one point there was a computer analysis done, but you really don't need to do that. It's very obvious once you start comparing quotations from Bill Ayers' work to Dreams from My Father. And I'm amazed that they're still sitting on this story after this time. I mean, that was one of the questions I was going to ask you. And I know we haven't gotten far enough into the book, but, you know, are we going to see the mainstream media ever pick up this story? Or do you think they'll try to sit on it all in 2012?
You know, Mark, what will have to precede that is for the respectable conservative media to pick up the story and demand that the mainstream media do. And they haven't done that yet. They're beginning to. With the book, it's, you know, you can take a few thousand word essay and make believe that it's not convincing, but you can't do that with an 80,000 word book. You know, as you say, the evidence is simply overwhelming. You don't even need computer analysis, and computer analysis just confuses things anyhow. The reader will see for himself just how stark and obvious the comparisons are, you know. This doesn't happen by accident, you know. It's not like they studied together or shared notes or something, you know. Plus, it was confirmed by Christopher Anderson in his book, Barack and Michelle, you know, a book that skews female and left in its audience. He'd have no vested interest in blowing Obama's cover, but he had sources within Hyde Park. He spent 6 pages on it, talking about how a hopelessly blocked Obama, you know, was deeply in debt, Michelle's on his butt, turns to Bill Ayers, friend and neighbor, drops off his notes and his unfinished manuscript and says, put this together for me, you know. And that he did.
It would seem so. That was the day that you were in a meeting and your pager started going off?
Yes, yeah, right. Yeah, because that was the day that Limbaugh started talking about it, you know, and when that happens, everything changes. And then in the second half of the book, I mean, I asked two questions in a book, basically. One, the first half of the book, I asked the question, did Obama write his own books? And the second half, which is, I think, for some people maybe even more interesting, is the story he tells true? And what I found is the answer to both questions, of course, is no. And the story, and this is where it gets interesting for me, because up until I started the book, I had avoided that whole birther issue because I had credibility problems enough, you know, getting my point across on the authorship. But once you start examining whether the book is true or not, then you realize that the story that Obama has been telling the world about his own origins is thoroughly false. And that is, I think, for me, was the revelation of writing the book, something that I didn't know at all getting into it.
Well, for those who don't know, you feel that Barack Obama essentially constructed his public persona, and this book actually goes about deconstructing that.
That's right, and they use that. That's one of those postmodern phrases that he and Ayers use. Not that Obama knows what it means, but Ayers does. And that is that, you know, you have those of us who grew up in the Judeo-Christian tradition have a whole set of values that we believe in that are shared and that work and that have worked for the last several thousand years. The postmodernist rejects all that and constructs his own reality. That's the word they use, construct. And it doesn't have to be true. It just has to be true for them. And so the job of the author or the critic like me is to deconstruct that reality, and that's what I do in the book. And what I discovered, Mark, is that the story he's been telling, the story of this improbable love, this great little family, their vision for their son, their vision for America, their coming together, their marriage, their living together for the first 2 years of his life in Hawaii, all a sham, not true. Remarkably and profoundly untrue. And it right under the nose of the major media. They simply chose not to see this. And it continues to stun me that they don't want to know it now, even though it's obvious. You know, I mean, there's no denying it, as you know.
I suppose next you're going to try to tell us that Barack Obama didn't have the typical African-American experience when he was growing up.
Well, he was no more African-American than you or I in terms of his experience. I mean, he lived in the least black state in America without Dakota in its name. You know, I mean, he grew up in a world in a white household. He didn't know any black people. He had like one other black student in his whole school, you know. I mean, he'd run into, you know, people in military and, you know, here and there, but his only connection with the black world of black America was through, unfortunately, through Frank Marshall Davis, who was a poet and a pornographer and a Communist Party member, you know, so that was his intro
let's
to
talk,
black
life. Let's
Pine.
Talk about that for a second. Among the people who believe that Obama was groomed from an early age, and I'm not pushing a Manchurian president type thing, but how does some kid who had been in Jakarta, who then comes to Hawaii, suddenly find himself being tutored by a well-known communist poet?
That's a good question. And that connection goes to his grandfather, Stanley Dunham, who is, I think, pretty, you know, the FBI files on Stanley Dunham have been lost or purposely lost or whatever, but Dunham was clearly a leftist, I don't know how deeply involved he was or how high up in the hierarchy was, or I can't imagine very high because I can't imagine he had much to offer. But Frank Marshall Davis is another story. And Dunham introduced young Barack to Davis when Barack was about 10 years old. And Davis, Davis is a pretty bright guy. He's an excellent writer, unlike Barack Obama. He grew up in the middle of Kansas in the early part of the 20th century when he probably experienced more discrimination in a day than Barack Obama did in his entire life. And he, in 1948, he gave up a lucrative career in Chicago. He was a very, well-received poet, editor, journalist, jazz buff, leaves all of that behind and moves to Hawaii just suddenly with his white socialite wife and his couple of children. And in Hawaii, though, his job is to serve as the main propagandist for the International Longshoremen Workers Union strike that was then choking Hawaii virtually to death. And he stayed there. He never left. He was a member of the Communist Party USA. That's documented beyond all doubt. The FBI has a 600-page file on him. And
so was he a big C or a little C communist?
Big C.
Gotcha.
Bill Ayers claims to be a little C communist. Frank Marshall Davis was a big C communist, and he was a big C communist in the years when to be a big C communist, like 45 to 55 especially, the Soviet Union had, in the Stalin years, had declared America to be its main enemy, its glavny vrag, and the Communist Party USA was a wholly owned subsidiary of the Communist Party Soviet Union. I mean, you were not an independent agent. You were not some free-thinking liberal. No, you were an apparatchik in the party machinery, and that's what Davis was. Now, he's a pretty smart guy. By the time Obama runs into him, this is in the mid-70s, Davis's, party activities have diminished, but his political philosophy hasn't changed, at least as far as we know. And he grooms the young lad. Now, the problem is, too, is that he's also a pornographer. And he has written a book called Sex Rebel Black, in which he professes to be his character, the Davis character in the book professes to be a bisexual and a voyeur, someone who likes, who doesn't have any hesitance having affairs with 13-year-olds. And this is the person that Obama's grandfather has left in the care of Davis. Davis is the person he left Obama in the care of, and they're, I'm not sure I would not consider that a good family values kind of thing to do, but that's what they did.
Wow.
And here's how I got into this too, Mark, because I was trying to stay out of the whole birth issue. But then someone sent me a copy of, and I had seen the poem before, I just hadn't paid much attention to it. There was a poem published under Barack Obama's name when he was 19 called Pop. It was published in the Occidental College Literary Review. And in which he talks about, the poem is a very sophisticated poem, much too sophisticated, in fact. It struck me as that right away, but about a relationship between a young boy and his older mentor, who's drunk, twitches, drinks, shares a drink with the young boy, et cetera, et cetera. And, so I went online to see what the critics had to say about this poem. And they said, a very sophisticated poem, signs of a young genius, Barack Obama, blah, blah, blah. And then they say the poem is clearly, every single one of them I read, and this is about half a dozen, that the poem is clearly a bittersweet tribute to his grandfather, Stanley Dunham, that is his mother's father. And so I'm thinking, okay, he calls his mother's father Gramps. Now, if I'm writing a poem about the guy I grew up calling Gramps, and I had a guy in my life called Gramps, I might not call it Gramps, but I wouldn't call it Pop. I mean, why would you call a poem about your grandfather Pop, unless that was his nickname, which it wasn't? Dunham's nickname was Gramps, that's clear. So then you have to start reading the poem a little more carefully. And the giveaway line in a poem is, when Pop stands up, recites a poem that he had written before his mother died, and then gives Obama a hug. Now, here's what we know about Stanley Dunham. The critics could have figured this out in a minute, that his mother committed suicide when he was 8 years old. Stanley Dunham is not a poet. So the notion that he remembered to recite a poem he had written before he was 8 years old is just utterly improbable. However, at age 20, when Frank Marshall Davis's mother died, he had already established himself as a poet of promise. He went to Kansas State University, an experience he actually loved. And it's clearly, when you see Davis in action, I've seen videos of Davis, in his description, Obama's, or the description of the old man in the poem, it's clear that the poem is about Frank Marshall Davis. And then when you get into Davis's poetry, you begin to see that the poem is not only about Frank Marshall Davis, but it is by Frank Marshall Davis. So Obama had made himself comfortable with a fraudulent literary career early on in his life, and from the time he was 19. In fact, after I wrote the book, Mark, I found a poem, also another Davis poem, under Obama's name in his high school literary magazine. So he was very comfortable with this, unfortunately much too comfortable with the notion of having other people write his stuff.
Well, he was not a serious student at all in high school. There's actually someone in our community who went to high school with him, and through a friend I've learned that her frequent comment is, you know, everybody loved Barry in high school. The only thing Barry cared about, the only two things he cared about were sports and marijuana.
Yeah.
And that's a,
I think he was
not a serious student.
No, he was like a B-minus student. And he didn't even start on his high school basketball team for, you know, it was a prep school, you know. And yet he goes to Occidental on a full scholarship. You know, that's interesting, too. But, you know, I mean, affirmative action could count for that. No, he wasn't. And he wasn't a good student in college. We know that because he did not graduate with honors from Columbia. Yet, despite the fact that he didn't graduate from honors and that he writes poorly, at that time his writing was terrible, he was... and it probably still terrible today. It was just that better editors. Despite that, he gets admitted to a law school, which takes only the top 1% of the students who apply. You know, you need grades typically of like 3.9 out of 4 and LSAT scores in the 98th, 99th percentile to get into Harvard Law School, unless you're Barack Obama.
Let me share a personal story. My son went to a private school, and I think he finished third in his class. And the young man who finished first applied to Harvard. He had a 4.0 his entire life, a nearly perfect SAT score, and scored in like the upper tenth of 1% on the National Latin exam. I kid you not, Mr. Cashel, Harvard wouldn't even look at him.
Yeah.
Yet you've got a kid who was a mediocre student by his own admission in high school, a mediocre student at Occidental, did not graduate from Columbia with honors, and somehow he gets into Harvard.
You know, and up until the time I started the book, Mark, I had presumed that someone was behind him, and I talk about that in the book about the whole Percy Sutton, you know, Khalid al-Mansur angle. But then when I realized that Michelle Obama got into Harvard and graduated from Harvard Law School, and I've seen her writing, which makes Obama look like Shakespeare. And
I saw that quote.
And she admits to being a bad test taker. You know, she admits to that. How she ever got into Harvard? I mean, how she got into Harvard is obvious. She's a graduate of Princeton. How she graduated from Princeton is another question. Or got in. But it's so flagrantly affirmative action oriented that they simply close their eyes and take them. And I actually talked to a Harvard professor about how do people like Michelle Obama get through. They said, well, when we see papers that are that bad, we know that they're affirmative action admission, and we take that into account. So she manages to graduate from Harvard Law School, but she's in over her head the moment she leaves school and tries to get a job at a law firm. Oh, she does. Everyone wants her. But she's... You can't fake it at a law firm where there's billable hours involved, you know?
Well, Al Gore went to Harvard, did he not? And his prior record was flunking out of seminary, if I'm not mistaken.
Yeah, he did, and then he tried law school for a while and didn't go through that. And I mean, his grades at Harvard were, uninteresting. You know, they were no better than George Bush's grades at Yale. His test scores weren't any better. I mean, you know, we passed him off as a genius, but there's a whole lot of people we've accepted as genius when they're not, you know, when they're very, you know, just average. I mean, it's not to say that Gore is stupid or Obama is stupid. They're just average students.
Well, if you take a look at those three collectively, and I guess you could probably throw John Kerry in there as well.
Yeah.
I mean, frankly, if Harvard doesn't start being more careful about which students they let in and which students they let out, before you know it, a degree from Harvard is going to be worth less than a Nobel Peace Prize.
Yeah, right. And deserve with the same amount of, you know, due diligence, you know. And in Obama's case, he's degraded both the Harvard degree and the Nobel Peace Prize. He shouldn't have accepted the latter. He shouldn't have accepted the former. He shouldn't have gone to Harvard. He should have gone, stuck around and gone to, like, Illinois State or something, you know, where he could probably have succeeded on his own merit rather than being, you know, finessed through on the basis of the fact that one of his parents was African-American, or not African, right, was black, or African-American. Or, I don't even know who his father was, but that's the second half of the book.
Well, you know, one of the things about this process that you went through, and I want to make sure I understand this correctly, at first you didn't immediately suspect Bill Ayers, but after looking at samples of Barack Obama's early writing, your response was, I don't know who in the heck wrote Dreams of My Father, but it certainly wasn't Barack Obama. Am I correct in that?
That's absolutely right. And then it would be another 6 to 8 weeks before I decided that Bill Ayers was the chief suspect. You know, and then by the time, I'd say within a week or two of the election, I was, I'd say, 98% sure. Now I'd say I'm 100% confident. I have no doubt.
Well, if we can reveal a little bit to the Tea Party listeners and share just a little bit of the book specifically, I mean, we're not going to give the whole thing away, but you have this great section in there where you essentially pick apart a piece that Obama had written, I guess, for a student newspaper at some point, and you go through and you break it down and point out all the mistakes. And I have to tell you, I am not the best person in the world when it comes to grammar. In fact, I'll share with you, as I engage in this sort of masochistic introspection, that when I was in college, every paper got back said A plus content, C minus grammar, and the overall grade was a B. I was happy to get the A plus on content, but you know, and I kind of skated on that, I guess. You know, I was able to go through there, and I found myself playing this little game. I was covering up what you had to say about it, and I would try to pick out everything I could as being only an average student in English. And I have to say, I'm very proud of this, I actually picked out every single noun-verb agreement problem,
well,
every single
yeah,
one.
Yeah, those
I
are
got.
Hard to miss.
But
I
need to brush up on my dangling participles.
Dangling participles, yeah, we can all do that. But noun-verb agreement, you know, when you say, but the taste of war are remote and far removed, yeah, I mean, that just jangles. I mean, you know, my kids went in third or fourth grade wouldn't have made those kind of mistakes, you know.
Would it be accurate to say that Barack Obama has a real problem when he writes determining what the subject of the sentence is? He seems to pick the word that is closest to the verb.
Yeah, right, because he gets lost in his own thoughts or in his own verbiage, you know. It's like one of the refuges of bad writers, and when they're in over the head, they try to throw in a lot of words and hope that no one notices that they're not saying anything at all, you know. So, I mean, for instance, you're right. Here's a sentence, and there are, by the way, and this is when he's a senior at Columbia at an Ivy League school. He writes an 1,800-word essay that's published. I don't know. Maybe they even edited it. Who knows? If they did, they didn't do him any favors. But there are five sentences in which the noun and the verb don't agree. I'll just read one here for you. The very real advantages of concentrating on a single issue is leading the National Freeze Movement to challenge individual missile systems while continuing the broader campaign. Now, the very real advantages, of course, are leading the National Freeze Movement. That is, if advantages could lead, but advantages don't lead. You know, people lead, or, you know, advantages. I mean, and then the while continuing, what is that referring to? You know, we don't know. That's a dangling whatever. It just dangles out there. You don't know what it's related to. There's five sentences like that. In fact, it was so bad, Mark, that when I went back after I started writing about this, I went back to the original because it wasn't digitized. And, I basically had to transcribe it word for word. And I I said, I wanted to make sure I didn't mess up in the transcription because the sentences were so bad. But what I found out is they were as bad as I thought they were. They were just bad, you know. There isn't, and if for the Obama faithful, here's the problem. In 1995, he publishes what Time magazine calls the best written memoir ever by an American political figure. Jonathan Raven, a British literary heavyweight, says Obama is the best writer to occupy the White House since Abraham Lincoln. And now here's an essay written while he's a senior in Ivy League school. He's you know, at that point in your life, you're 90% as good a writer as you'll ever be, even if you keep working at it, which you didn't do. And there's not a single sentence in the whole essay that has the hint of style or grace or promise. And the sentences that are there are so clunky and awkward and ill-structured. You know, I mean, you wouldn't pass this. You'd give this a D, I mean, as a student paper. 5 years later, he writes an article for called Why Organize, for a book called After Alinsky. And it's only marginally better, and that's only probably because he had a better editor. But the same lack of style, lack of grace, lack of promise, you know, lack of any kind of poetic or lyrical flair. Because Dreams from My Father is a very poetic book, very lyrical. And when you read it, whoever wrote it, you're thinking, my gosh, this guy can really string a sentence together. That's not Barack Obama. And it should have been obvious to everyone who picked up, every literary person, every literary critic who picked up that book in the first five pages should have said to themselves, I wonder who wrote this. And none of them. I thought we'd find others who did, but none of them did.
Well, in this politically correct world that we live in, wouldn't anyone who questioned that be immediately labeled a racist?
Yes, they would, and just as like David Remnick, who's Obama's biographer, takes me and Rush Limbaugh out to the woodshed and calls us racist, you know, for daring to criticize Obama's writing. And he says that kind of thing has an ugly pedigree. Well, there's 1,000 books have been written on who wrote Shakespeare. You know, is that racist? Who wrote Homer? Is that racist? Come on, this is crazy. Who wrote Profiles in Courage? That's another, the John F. Kennedy Pulitzer Prize-winning 1956 nonfiction work that was written, in fact, by Ted Sorensen, not by John F. Kennedy. If that had come out, that Sorensen wrote Profiles in Courage before the 60 election, Kennedy would not have been nominated, let alone won. Same thing with Dreams of My Father and Barack Obama. If it had come out before the election, that Bill Ayers had written that, as David Remnick says, that would have ended the candidacy. What he calls the diabolical potency of it. Well, it's not diabolical. What's diabolical is having other people write your books. What's angelic is pointing it out, you know.
But as you point out in your book, that's pretty common in the political world to have someone else ghostwrite your book for you. But at the same time, whenever so much is invested in this book in terms of being the proof that Barack Obama is a genius, and then when you consider the flip side of Obama trying to distance himself from Bill Ayers, this could have been a real double whammy for him.
Right. For instance, if it had come out that John F. Kennedy's book, Profiles in Courage, was not ghostwritten by Ted Sorensen, but by, say, Alger Hiss, or, you know, Julius Rosenberg, you know, I mean, that would have been very scandalous. You know, he would have been thrown out of the Senate. He would have been.
Of course, Obama was only 8 years old when Bill Ayers was blowing stuff up. So, I mean, isn't this just guilt by association, Jack?
That's what they said. And, you know, and they kept on using that old canard. Well, in the 60s, blah, blah, blah. Well, no, Ayers didn't start blowing stuff up until the 70s. Throughout the 70s, Obama was a voting age by the time Ayers came out of underground, and it wasn't like they tried to throw it back a decade. Just that's a cheap little bit of theatrics to excuse Obama from doing what he did.
Frankly, Jack, I'm 2 years younger than Barack Obama, and Barack Obama being willing to serve not only on the Woods Foundation board with Bill Ayers, but also, you know, being Bill Ayers' handpicked choice to lead the Chicago Annenberg Challenge, and not, you know, blinking for one moment or thinking for one moment that wow, this guy was a terrorist in the 60s, I shouldn't be associating with this guy, would be no different than if I suddenly found myself palling around, if I can borrow a term from Sarah Palin, with someone who was a member of the Manson family. Oh, yeah, well, you know, they killed that Tate girl back in the 60s.
Right. Or Terry Nichols, you know? Yeah, Terry Nichols, he didn't actually plant the bomb. That was Timothy McVeigh who did that, you know. I mean, the difference between Ayers, Bill Ayers and Timothy McVeigh is simply competence. It wasn't intent, you know. Ayers was, McVeigh was simply more competent than Bill Ayers as a terrorist. That's unfortunately
I think
a good thing for history, but it's true.
I think Dick Morris may have put it best when he said, well, if the Weather Underground didn't kill a bunch of people, it wasn't for a lack of trying. It's like you
That's
said,
exactly
they're just,
right.
They were just incompetent at it. Well, okay, so the light bulb came on. First you said, hey, there's no way Barack Obama wrote this. He's too poor a writer. And then you said, hey, maybe Barack Obama and Bill Ayers, because they both live in Chicago, share the same ghostwriter. And then you said to yourself, hey, I think Bill Ayers actually wrote big chunks of this thing. Pick up the story from there.
Yeah, well, what happens then is then I, by that time, I go public with that, and my evidence is getting stronger and stronger. And one other bit of evidence was that Rashid Khalidi, another Hyde Park radical, a PLO spokesman, attributes in his book, Resurrecting Empire, first sentence of the acknowledgement, first section in the acknowledgements page, it starts off, first and foremost, chronologically in every other way, is Bill Ayers. Bill Ayers helped him write his book. That's the service that Bill Ayers provided for his radical pals in Hyde Park. He and Bernadine Dorn, his weather woman wife, were the sort of the, as Remnick says, the Elsa Maxwell of that neighborhood. They were the social center. That's exactly the kind of service he would provide. Ayers is 17 years older than Obama. He's, you know, people say, why would Obama hang around with Ayers? The real question was, why would Ayers hang around with Obama? In 1995, it was Ayers who had the power and the street cred and the clout in Chicago that Obama lacked. What Ayers was doing, I'm convinced, was grooming not a president of the United States, but a mayor of Chicago. And having the appearance of an African-American gave Obama the ability to say and do things that Ayers could not do on his own, especially dealing with Chicago's largely black educational bureaucracy. And so I came forward. By mid-October, I knew I had this story down. But I got no help from anyone on our side in the conservative media. None, other than, I take this back, from the blogosphere. American Thinker, WorldNet Daily, Talk Radio, hats off here to Rusty Humphreys in particular. And But the story went nowhere. It died. And with it, Obama was elected. Now, then I picked it up later on in the second part of the book, and I think would be of interest to some people, because once I got into the poem Pop, Mark, that I mentioned, I realized that there were questions, real questions, about the paternity of Barack Obama. It's not a settled issue. Why the poem about Frank Marshall Davis, who's black, is called Pop, is a question that had to be answered. And that's, and I get into that, and I do sort of a paternity sweepstakes. And sort of, I don't draw a conclusion because I'm not sure I know the answer, but I lay out all the various scenarios. And finally, I mean, it's as likely that Davis is Barack Obama's real father as Barack Obama is the real father, Barack Obama Sr. And you can't rule out the fact that she might have been Ann Dunham, the mom, might have been impregnated before the family left for Hawaii as well. There could be someone unknown back on the mainland. So you go through the whole scenario, and then you realize that the story Obama has been telling about his first 2 years is totally false. The family never lived together. Obama spent the first year of his life in Seattle with his mother while Barack Obama Sr. was back in Hawaii. By the time Ann and Barry return to Hawaii, Barack is gone for Harvard. They never lived together. In fact, he probably never saw the child. In fact, they probably never dated. They probably never married. And yet, Obama continues to insist that they lived together until he was at least 2 years old. And at the end of the day, Mark, we know less about the first 2 years of Obama's life than we do about George Washington's. And it's, I'm not even exaggerating. That's the weird thing. How could we not know in this era? You know, I've read at least four biographies of Barack Obama, including one by the New York Times, and they all have their little family living together for the first couple of years in Hawaii. We know that now to be totally false. The Hawaii, the Washington State history sites show where Barack Obama lived, and they brag about it, unaware that they're, you know, blowing holes in the whole cover story of this great improbable romance. And why this matters is because he rode to the presidency on the back of that story. That story was critical to his own political ascendancy because they told it over and over and over again. They kept embellishing it. They told it in both convention speeches right off the bat. We wanted to vote for Obama because he was the sort of the epitome of this multicultural ideal, this coming together, this improbable love, this sharing in the future of America, blah, 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 blah. False, 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 false.
Why would you think that Stanley, and I'm talking about his mother now.
Yeah, right.
She, why do you think she would
Dan to distinguish her from the old man who was also called Stanley, you know?
That's another story in and of itself, but
yeah.
Very strange family. But why do you think Stanley would have preferred to tell Barry that his father was Barack Obama instead of Frank Marshall Davis?
Well, for one, Davis was married and had a couple little kids. And so the possibility is that, first of all, and Barack Obama Sr., by the way, was not only was he black, but he was also a communist sympathizer, and he spoke at communist front rallies. It's impossible that he could not have known Frank Marshall Davis at that time. I mean, it's very unlikely that they would not have known each other. They would not have run into each other at these kind of events. And it's, you know, as I see it happening, and here's just one other factor I'm going to throw in, which made me realize, I think that maybe Davis is the father. At first I was skeptical. But I was on the nude photos of Ann Dunham floating around the internet. And I set out to disprove that. I said, okay, let me just see if I could disprove that these are Ann Dunham. So I went to Snopes, which is a reliable service to deflecting rumors that might imperil the Obama presidency, and they, of course, said it was false, that those photos, and you've probably seen them, Mark, are not...
Actually, I have not. I don't do a lot of searches for naked president's moms.
Well, I would say this, is just go to Google Images and put in Ann Dunham, and you'll get there. But
you're assuming I want to see them, but go ahead.
Well, here's the funny thing. So I go to Snopes, and Snopes is an unreliable truth teller, but they're a reliable defender of Barack Obama. And they put a big fat false on this rumor. Are these photos of Ann Dunham? And they're unretouched, they say. They're real photos, but they're photos, says Snopes, of 1950s pinup model Marcy Moore. Well, then I went and found photos of Marcy Moore to see if this was true. And Marcy Moore photos can be found in this wonderfully trashy reference site called Boobapedia, you know, and that's what it's called. Really.
You certainly know your way around the back alleys of the internet.
I'm just learning. It's the only time I've been to Boobapedia. Trust me. And
all in the name of research, right, Jack? Okay.
All in the name of research. Marcy Moore, in addition to being much prettier than the woman in the photos, is much more ample. You know, is much more physical. Anne is young and perky, but she's no match for the professional body of Marcy Moore. It's transparent. In one look at it, you know that the woman in these photos is not Marcy Moore. But the woman in photos, I concluded at the end of the day, is Ann Dunham. And here are just some clues that you know, you come to. One is, it's a Christmas setting. So it's, there's Christmas tree in the background, and these are amateur photos. It's not like they staged it to look like Christmas. On the coffee table is a copy of Cuban Fire, a new album by Stan Kenton, jazz album. The woman in the photo looks for all the world like, and her hair is the right length, chin, eyes, mouth, everything. Not only that, but she has a tan line where her shorts would be, and this is December. There's not many places in America where you can have a tan line in December in 1960. For another, as I was reading Frank Marshall Davis's memoir, I realized that, in fact, he was a photographer, and that as soon as he got his photography equipment, he immediately turned to nude photographing. And he said that white women, black women, blah, 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 they all like to have their picture taken. And then he also says in the book that he's a derriere man. You know, that's his particular fetish. And the photos of Ann Dunham, which are relatively tasteful by today's standards, are all sort of derriere-centric. You know, they're butt-centric. So they're photographed from the back, or, you know, from the butt forward. So every single detail fit.
I'm gonna have to change the classification on the show today, Jack. I had it set for family and everyone, but
well, notice that my choice of words though has always been discreet. I have not used any bad word other than the boobopedia, but that's, you know, that's in the name of science. But in any case, that's so if they were that intimate at that time that he would be taking nude photos of her. By the way, and he was a huge jazz buff, so the jazz album fits as well. Then it becomes altogether likely that the pop in the poem about allegedly by Obama means more is a literal title for Frank Marshall Davis in his role in Barack Obama's life. He can't be ruled out. I mean, he is a suspect.
Okay, two things. I would suggest at this point that you call some of your CSI friends and have them do that computer facial recognition thing and the computer aging thing on those photos. And then the other thing is, much in the spirit of your construction friend, I've had it. I'm going to take the reins and go with it. I'm flying to Kenya. I'm going to get George. I'm going to knock on the door of the shack. I'm going to have George give me a DNA sample. And then I'll have to find someone else to help me get one from Barack Obama, and we're going to compare the two, and we're going to get this taken care of.
Grab a hairbrush or something, you know. So, yeah, that would be interesting.
Might work.
Because so much depends on his being the child of Africa, you know. But if he's the child of someone in America, just an average, ordinary African American, all the glamour, all the romance, it's all gone.
Wow. You know, there's so many things out there. I had, and I know you know this gentleman, I had Eric Rush on at one point, and he said there were, of course, accusations that Barack Obama was homosexual, and that when it became readily apparent that Barack Obama was a true contender in the Democratic primaries, suddenly two homosexuals at Barack Obama's church, with whom Barack Obama had been very familiar, were murdered. And also, in one of the cases, the very last of the choir director, the very last phone call he made shortly before being murdered was to someone within the Barack Obama campaign. So we've got that floating out there. We've got Anita Moncrief's Acorn story floating out there. Now we find out that Frank Marshall Davis may actually be pop. And wow, it just seems to me that if any of these accusations had been thrown at Sarah Palin or George W. Bush, the mainstream media would have taken a little more interest.
Oh, no doubt about it. Had I been writing this book about Sarah Palin, I wouldn't be talking to you today. I'd be talking to Katie Couric, you know? And let's face it, not no offense, Mark. I mean,
what are you saying, Jack? that's just fine. Yeah, let's see how much of your...
but you're much cuter than she is.
Oh, well, thank you. I was going to say, let's see how much of the book she reads before the interview. I saw a 30-minute patty cake interview she did with Al Gore where she didn't ask one real question the entire time. Okay, so bring us up to the present. I mean, you obviously have done some great work, and the book shows numerous comparisons between Bill Ayer's work and Barack Obama's work. You don't need a computer, and I know the book goes through some of the computer analysis that was done. You don't need a computer to see it. It's as plain as the nose on your face, and maybe even as plain as the nose on Bill Maher's face. So you can see this readily, even as an amateur looking at this. But bring us up to the present. When do you see yourself gaining some type of mainstream acceptance, if not with the left media, but maybe some of the respectable conservative media?
Well, you know, the book came out last week, and I knew right from the beginning there would be a struggle. I saw my role as, I mean, to find a champion within the conservative ranks. You know, and that's what I've been looking for. I went to CPAC even, which was zoo, but I've never been. I think I'm beginning to make headway. Now that the book is out, and one thing I did I think that will cause some stir, and I think this is going to, it'll make it, because it goes into the homes of people who are not suspecting it, is that I did a book TV for C-SPAN. I recorded it a week ago, and it'll air probably in about 2 weeks. And with the book TV, they give you an hour. I mean, it's unedited, right? And I made my case very quietly and dispassionately, and I had an audience of 300 people at a public library in Kansas City where I live. And what will happen is that book TV is watched by, well, readers, which is one thing. And I'm sure their audience isn't that great, but their book TV has the ability to come into people's homes or not suspecting it. And so whenever I do a book TV, I've done five previous ones for five previous books, I always get angry emails from, how dare you come into my living room, you know? Well, this time they're going to be beyond angry. You know, they're going to demand answers. They're going to demand my head. And I said, bring it on, you know, bring it on.
Well, Jack, I appreciate you being here today. It has been an absolute pleasure.
Thank you for having me, Mark. It's always fun.
I've enjoyed it.
Who's been reading the book?
I actually have. I don't like my authors or my listeners. I'm about 200 pages in, and I'm hooked, and I can't wait to finish the rest of it. But more importantly, for people listening right now who would like to order a copy of the book themselves, we actually have it posted on our website. We also have a link to Hoodwink, as well as a link to Ron Brown's Body. So ordering one of those three directly from our website. And also, I'm sure you get involved in public speaking. If someone should wish to have you speak at your event, how should they get in touch with you, Jack?
Just go to cashel.com, which is my website, and where it says contact Jack, just email me, and that's the easiest way to do it. Cashel, CASHILL.com.
Very good. Well, thank you for being here today, and we'll be looking forward to you in that Katie Couric interview sometime soon.
Hey, Mark, thanks for having me. It's a lot of fun. Bye-bye.
Bye.
You've been listening to the Tea Party Power Hour with Mark Gillar, a production of the Conservative Broadcasting Network.